Here he is, Ed Sullivan.
Thank you, Greg. Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation, and these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them. Right now and again in the second half of our show, ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles! That's...
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Welcome to The Point, I'm Mindy Todd. That was February 7th, 1964. Today we take a look at the impact of the Beatles on not only the music scene, but pop culture. And with us is Robert Wyatt, Steinway Artist, Smithsonian Institution Lecturer, and Specialist in American Music. Welcome back.
Hello, Mindy.
This is so exciting. Yes. I remember that Ed Sullivan show. I think my cousin told me I kissed the TV. I don't remember that, but she says I did.
They were overnight sensations. From that moment on, they were just the stars of the world.
And that was interesting because as they arrived at Kennedy Airport, there were thousands of teenagers, and even the Beatles were surprised. They're like, who's landing? Who, you know, what are all these people here for?
They heard the sound and they thought it was the jet engine still running, but it was the people outside.
Ed Sullivan knew what he was doing here. I guess he was in London at the Heathrow Airport, and he thought, who, you know, again, what is all this commotion? Who
yes.
is this, right? And
I have to buy these people.
Yeah.
And he did for $10,000 for three performances. That was
yeah.
nothing.
Yeah. Immediately, I mean, they were charming and they were witty, and Beatlemania swept the country.
Yes, they were handsome. I thought of cosmic convergence, that Bach, Handel, and Domenico Scarlatti were all born in 1685. And then what's the chance of four of the most sensational musicians being born within 3 years apart in Liverpool, England, and became the most famous band ever?
Yeah. And we'll get into some of the reasons why that is. But it's interesting, too, in their early days, they played a lot in bands and in Germany. And
yes.
really, I always think it's a good way to judge a band is if you can do live in those bars and things, that really brings you together for what's to come later on.
Well, when they were in Hamburg, they just played all the time. And they didn't really care because they were getting paid a little bit of money, but they were sensational and they got to gyrate on stage. And that was what they really wanted to do. Yeah, they wanted to have fun.
And of course, they had the look. They had the mop top, as they called it.
Yes. The hair was always an issue. I remember my mother thinking, look at their hair. If you look at it now, it's like nothing.
Brian Epstein became their manager, and he had a real impact on their look before they arrived in America.
Yes, he was running a music shop in Liverpool, and he heard the Beatles singing at the Cavern Club, and he just became entranced with them. And he decided to become their manager, so he invited them and turned them really into what they became.
I really like the early music. I mean, I like it all, but the early, maybe because of the age I was at the time, it really strikes a chord. Let's talk a little bit. We're going to hear Love Me Do. Let's talk a little bit about Love Me Do.
When you hear it, it's John Lennon playing the harmonica at the very beginning. I said, John Lennon plays the guitar, harmonica too. It was the first single released by the Beatles, but it only hit 17 on the pop list. That's when George Martin comes in. It was really Brian Epstein, George Martin, who was the head of EMI, the first company to sign the Beatles, the only company to sign the Beatles. He was not sure of Ringo Starr, so we got another drummer for that first song, Love Me Do. But eventually, Ringo Starr made the grade, and Richard Starkey became the drummer for the Beatles.
I love you. I'll always
So on that first night on the Ed Sullivan Show, the first set included All My Loving, Loving Till There Was You, and She Loves You. And of course, it's so fun to go back and look at that and watch all these screaming girls in the audience. I think some of them might have even passed out. What's interesting, 73 million viewers. Davy Jones, not yet of Monkees fame, was also on that show that night.
Really?
Yeah, he was in Oliver. How'd you like to be poor Fred Capps, the magician who had to follow them?
He was from Europe and he couldn't speak that one. He kept using the same word over and over. This is a new trick.
So obviously the Beatles didn't realize what being on Ed Sullivan meant. And they had done lots of TV in Britain. And Paul attributed their hair to much of their original attention. And here we hear John's answer to a reporter's question about their hair.
Tell me, first of all, is the haircut an act by accident or design?
Accident.
You didn't have time to get your hair cut in the first place.
Yeah. No, it just happened, you know. Ringo's was a bit by design, because he joined later.
I designed it.
How often do you get your hair cut, by the way?
We try not to mention that.
It's a dirty word.
Sometimes the reporters of that day ask some really silly questions.
He said you had unresolved leading tones, a false modal frame, ending up as a plain diatonic. What would you say to that?
We're going to see a doctor about that.
I must tell you, by the way, that Detroit University have got to stamp out the Beatle movement.
I know.
We've heard about Detroit. They think your haircuts are un-American.
Well, it was very observant of them, because we aren't American, actually.
True, though.
True.
After the Ed Sullivan Show, they soared. And 2 days later, they went to the D.C.'s Washington Coliseum for 2 concerts, and then back to New York for 2 concerts at Carnegie Hall. So when they returned to London, they had conquered the United States.
Another favorite of a lot of folks of the early songs is Please Please Me. That was a big hit.
When they came to the EMI studio, they recorded 10 songs in a single day for their debut long-playing record. And it hit number one in April 1963 and remained for 30 weeks, only to be replaced by With the Beatles 7 months later. Mm-hmm. Over a year, the Beatles were on top.
Last night I said these words to my
things that they talk a lot about, if you look back in some of these early interviews, is they talk about this Mersey beat, right? Because this was the English invasion at this point. There were a lot of other bands coming out of England at this time.
John Lennon said they all had this Mersey beat, but they all were different. So the Beatles were like different. They didn't want to be just another band. They want to be the band.
What is the Mersey sound? How does it differ from other rock and roll and pop?
It doesn't really. It just happened that all of a sudden hundreds of rock groups all from Liverpool made records, and it was a bit more like the original rock and roll than the stuff they've had over the last few months. Ah. So people decided suddenly, you know, there's all these Liverpool groups, so they call it the Liverpool sound and the Mersey beat and everything else.
And the Nicky Cuff all things.
Yeah, but it's just, yeah.
Just a way of classifying it, but I don't think the music's very different.
Let's talk a little bit about the impact of George Martin, often referred to as the fifth Beatle. And I think if anybody deserves that title, it is George Martin. He is really instrumental in helping their sound.
Yes. Well, he was a classically trained musician. He took over EMI, which was the recording label, the parlophone that the Beatles use, at the age of 25. He arranged music, he composed music, he produced music, and he was a very fine pianist. So when he would listen to the recordings, he would add things. He was like the Moss Hart of American musical theater. He could fix anything, he could add anything, he could make their sound even better. So he really did, you know, become like a fifth person on the stage.
Yeah. And when you think about the talents, you think of the songwriting of Lennon, McCartney, and then George Martin, and just sort of that, I guess, all being open to each other's suggestions and ideas, that really cemented, you know, their sound.
And they kept changing. It was never the same. They didn't just stagnate on something that worked well. They kept adding more and more electronics, more vocals, more harmony, more emotion. Everything was always changing with the Beatles for 8 years. They just changed.
It's amazing when you think about that. It was just such a short period of time, only 8 years.
8 years.
All right, so I Want to Hold Your Hand, another big early hit for the Beatles.
It was really just two guys jamming and having fun. John Lennon said, "I remember when we got the chord that made the song, and we had, oh, you got something, and Paul records this chord, and I turned to him and say, that's it. I said, do that again. In those days, we really used to absolutely write like that, both playing into each other's notes. In the first 3 days, it sold 250,000 copies. In New York alone, 10,000 copies every hour.
Oh, yeah, I tell you something. I think you'll understand. When I say that something, I want to hold your hand. Such a feeling that my love, I can hide. Yeah, you got that something. I think you understand. When I feel that something, I wanna hold your hand.
Wrote Can't Buy Me Love at a hotel in Paris after having an upright piano wheeled into his suite. As for what the song meant, Paul once told a reporter that, in his words, the idea behind the song was that all these material possessions are all very well, but they won't buy me what I really want. However, he was to comment later, it should have been Can Buy Me Love, when reflecting on the perks that money and fame had brought him. The song hit number one in April 1964 and stayed at the top of the Billboard chart for 4 weeks.
Can't buy me love, love, can't buy me love. I'll buy you a diamond ring, my friend, if it makes you feel all right. I'll get you anything, my friend, if it makes you feel all right. 'Cause I don't care too much for money, but money can buy me love. I'll give you all I've got to give if you say you love me too. I may not have a lot to give, but what I got I'll give to you. I don't care too much for money, but money can buy me love. Can buy me love. Everybody tells me so. Satisfied. Tell me that you want the kind of things the money just can't buy. I don't care too much for money. Money can buy me love. Just can't buy. I don't care too much for money. Money can buy me love. Now buy me love. Love. Buy me love.
We are discussing Beatlemania. More after a break. You're listening to The Point. American music specialist Robert Wyatt is discussing the popularity of the Beatles.
You know, it's interesting, too, when you look at the songwriting abilities of John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Very different. And I think Paul McCartney, we talked about George Martin and his influence, but one of the things, Paul McCartney had that vaudeville background and, you know, in his family. And although Paul and John were very different, I think their difference is what really made them such great songwriters.
Absolutely. When they first met, when they were young men, John Lennon had never composed a piece, a song. And so he heard Paul McCartney doing it and says, oh, wouldn't that be interesting? So he started doing it too. And they just would feed off each other and introduce a chord, introduce a word, until finally everything came together.
One of the songs that we like to hear the story about is Yesterday. Probably that might be the most covered song of theirs, right? I mean, everybody has a version of Yesterday.
They do. And Paul McCartney said that, I was living in a little flat at the top of a house, and I had a piano by my bed. I woke up one morning with a tune in my head, and I thought, hey, I don't know that tune, or do I? It was like a jazz melody. My dad used to know a lot of old jazz tunes. I thought maybe I just remembered it from the past. I went to the piano, found the chords to it, made sure I remembered it, then hawked it around to my friends, asking what it was. Do you know this? It's a good little tune, but I couldn't have written it because I dreamt it.
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Why she had I said something wrong. Now I long for yesterday, yesterday. Love was such an easy game to play. Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
One of the interesting things about the Beatles, that there wasn't really a leader. You know, they played as a group, even though some people thought John was the leader. Other rock and roll groups, you know, were solo acts, or they had, you know, somebody who led it. This was sort of interesting. And all four of them were equally as witty and charming.
Yes, in different ways. It started off being John's band. He had the Quarrymen, you know, back at the very beginning. Then when Paul McCartney came, they added a lot. But then George Harrison was only 15 years old when he joined them. 15 years old. John Lennon didn't want such a kid on stage with him. And it was a few years later that Ringo Starr became the drummer after Pete Best didn't make the grade. And then the rest is all history.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because you think back, who's your favorite Beatle, right? And they each of them had, like, fans galore, as we know. This is from Marty Sandler's book, How the Beatles Changed the World. He talks about the letters, and here's a letter that one of them, "My darling, dear, delightful Ringo, could you please send me something of yours? Anything, a lock of hair, a smoked cigarette, a thread from your coat, a button from your shirt, a piece of old toast, or a bristle from your toothbrush. I would treasure it forever. My love, Mary L."
What rascals.
But, you know, when you think about it, they arrived at some of their performances and press conferences in an armored car.
Yes, they were sensational. They always were worried about being accosted because people were so frantic to be with them, to touch them. They always were a little bit worried.
Pull a little piece, as we're seeing it in that letter. All right, so the next piece we're going to hear is Norwegian Wood. Tell us a little bit about Norwegian
Wood. Well, John Lennon had the idea for this song while he was on a skiing holiday with his wife in the Swiss Alps. And he was then writing songs for Rubber Soul. And Norwegian Wood was interesting, a song about an affair that John Lennon was having at the time. So skiing with his wife, he wrote a song about an affair he was having. And it was a landmark recording for the Beatles because it was one of the first Western pop songs to feature the sitar. It was also a time when they were heavily experiencing marijuana. So it was a different type of new sound, and it was a very exciting sound. George Martin said it was the first album to present a new, growing Beatles to the world.
She once had me. She showed me her room. Isn't it good? Norwegian wood. She asked me to stay and she told me to sit anywhere. So I looked around and I noticed there wasn't a chair. I sat on the she said, it's time for bed.
introduction of the sitar really was more George's idea, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. His wife had brought him into the meditation practice, and they found the Maharishi, and things grew from that. Eventually, they all four went to India to study with the Maharishi in transcendental meditation. Mm. They didn't all stay very long.
Right, right. And as we see, it's interesting, too, as you watch this, again, small amount of time, 8 years, and how much they grew, not only as musicians, but, I mean, the popularity. And here you have these four guys who are together all the time.
Yes.
Right, when they're, and, you know, the popularity is just... And they do the movies, and then, you know, you have these throngs of people, men and women, chasing them down. Really got to be too much that they eventually did have to stop touring. They decided to stop touring. But while they were, I'm thinking back to, I think it was when they were at Shea Stadium, the screaming was so loud they couldn't even hear what they were playing. Did it really matter? Because who could hear it? But they, was it Jelly Bean? There was some sort of candy that they had said they liked that they were throwing at them on the stage, and they talk about their boots, you know, sticking to all of this candy that people were throwing at them. But you can just imagine how wild that must have been.
Yes. One of the reasons they stopped playing on stage was because they couldn't hear themselves, and they couldn't do the electronic masterful things that they could do in the studio. So why still be on stage?
Right. All right, let's talk about Eleanor Rigby.
Critics and fans hailed the Revolver album as one of the greatest albums ever made. Jeff Emerick, the new EMI recording engineer, said, "The band encouraged us to break the rules and ensure that each instrument should sound unlike itself." Paul McCartney says, "I thought I swear that I made up the name Eleanor Rigby like that. It seems that up in Woolton Cemetery, where I used to hang out with John, there's a gravestone to an Eleanor Rigby. Apparently, a few yards to the right, there comes someone called Mackenzie."
Look at all the lovely people. Look at all the lovely people. Eleanor Rigby picks up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people, where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong? Father Mackenzie, writing the words of a sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near, look at him working, darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there. What does he care? All the lonely people, where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong?
Think about, you know, we talk a lot about the Lennon-McCartney songwriting team. What about Ringo and George? They certainly had songwriting talent. Do you think that they were underappreciated in the early years?
Yes. George was the lead guitar, and he really had chops. But they didn't really think of him as being a composer or a singer. But he eventually fit in as he got older. Ringo was always a little bit the clown. And I, as a younger man, thought that he was the Beatles who was less important. Mm-hmm. But he was a tremendous drummer. If you just listen to the drum tracks, he was sensational.
Let's talk a little bit about, George wrote something that was about his wife at the time.
Yeah, Something was George Harrison's finest moment on Abbey Road, one of the record's undisputed highlights that showed him finally leaving the songwriting shadow of Lennon and McCartney. I had written Something on the piano during the recording of the White Album. There was a period during that album when we were all in different studios doing different things, trying to get it finished. And I used to take some time out. So I went into an empty studio and wrote Something. Now, Frank Sinatra considers Something to be the greatest love song of the past 50 years.
It is an absolutely beautiful song. If you really stop and listen to that, you know, it's really quite lovely.
Something in the way she moves attracts me like no other lover. Something in the way she woos me. I don't want to leave her now.
We're discussing Beatlemania. We'll talk more after a quick break. Let's talk about the tensions in the Beatles. As they, you know, they're so popular, and you know, they've you know, we've had the early success, we've had the movies, and we're moving along, and their sound is changing. And you know, a lot of people don't realize, I mean, all this togetherness is really starting to wear on them, and they each have ideas of what they want to do, and that tension ultimately ends up in their breaking up. Many critics have called Hey Jude one of the greatest songs of all time. Paul wrote the song during a time of upheaval for the group. The ballad evolved from Hey Jules, a song to comfort John Lennon's son Julian after Lennon had left his wife for Yoko Ono. Hey Jude spent 9 weeks at number one in 1968, and at 7 minutes was the longest song ever to top the charts until that time.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better. Hey Jude, don't be afraid. You were made to. Skin, then you begin to make
Well, they were young men growing older. They have met women, they had life experiences, and they just didn't have as much fun together as they did at the beginning. When you hear the early interviews, they were so raucous and so much a team, you know. Then when they grew older, they had their own interests, and they no longer needed the money to do all the things that they wanted to do. So they just grew apart. They had different ideas. They had different enterprises, and they had different women.
Yeah. And poor Yoko got blamed for that.
She did. She did.
Yoko really wasn't the reason they
broke up. Not at all. They would have broken up no matter what, because they were independent young men.
And of course we had that big scandal. Paul is dead. Remember that? I think
yes,
to this
Abbey
day
Road.
There are people who think that this is a Paul impersonator. Pretty good one, right?
The barefoot man crossing Abbey Road.
That's right. And I guess you can read conspiracy theories into all kinds of things, can't you?
Yes. It took him a while, though, to say, no, I am alive. He was in Scotland. He finally exposed himself.
Yeah, well, I mean...
Living Paul McCartney.
Yeah, the publicity is pretty good for selling records, I would think, right?
Exactly.
The other big highlight, I think, back to on some of the press conferences is, remember when John made that mention that they were more popular than Jesus? And that really set off a firestorm of controversy. And I thought it was interesting. I was looking at a press conference from 1966 in LA. They keep bringing it up. And John is like, he's like, all right, I've explained this enough times by now. And what I love is there's obviously a reporter in there who has a great sense of humor, because he says, John, is it true you'll be leaving the Beatles to study comparative religion? So funny. All right. So let's talk about the long and winding road.
Well, it really summed up the fraught nature of the Beatles' final months. Lennon said, Paul again. He had a little spurt just before we split. I think the shock of Yoko Ono and what was happening gave him a creative spurt, including Let It Be and Long and Winding Road, because that was a last gasp from him.
One of the interesting little tidbits about the Long and Winding Road is that George Martin was not a part of this.
No, and Let It Be wasn't really the last album. They'd recorded it before Abbey Road. But George Martin did not do the album, but Phil Spector, the man who was famous for creating the wall of sound for a lot of 1960s pop acts.
Mostly girl bands like the Ronettes, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, he changed things that the Beatles did not approve of, so they didn't really endorse his version.
Robert Wyatt is giving a talk on the Beatles at Falmouth Academy May 4th at 10 a.m. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The long and winding road that leads to your door will never disappear. I've seen that road before. Lead me to your door, the wild and windy night that the rain washed away. Has left a pool of tears, crying for
Wish I saved my Beatles wallet. Only you know what photo I had inside my Beatles wallet? Dino, Desi, and Billy. Remember that trio? Dino, Desi, and Billy. I had a photo of Dino, Desi, and Billy in my Beatles wallet.